As the war began, Britain began to be drawn into the conflict, not so much supplying huge armies in Europe to defy the French threat, but by providing money and having a strong Royal Navy, which indeed had to develop its own strong Royal Naval Service, medical service, which it did. There were certain evolutions in the French wars, and these were the fact that some very prominent surgical figures came to light and wrote about their experiences. In the French forces, François Percy and Baron Jean-Dominique Larrey head the most important surgical figures, and they brought in some evolutions which we will discuss shortly. So we now have to look at how a young surgeon or an aspirant surgeon would train for the British Army or the Royal Navy. Often these men came from middle-class families. Their education had to be paid for by their parents, and they would be apprenticed to a metropolitan or city surgeon, provincial surgeon, or apothecary or physician. The apprenticeship would be an indentured agreement. The parents would pay, and the apprentice would often live with his master and be taught both his good and his bad habits. This apprenticeship would probably last about 5 years, sometimes shorter in times of war, when there was great demand on doctors, particularly in France. Then, after being signed off as an apprentice, the student would attend a hospital in the provinces or the city and attend ward rounds, observe some operations, and keep records and act as plaster men, people who would administer dressings, and house surgeons. They would have some pay and coal and candles given as an allowance. After 2 years, they would have to sit an examination at one of the authoritative bodies, one of the Royal Colleges. There were two in Scotland, the Royal College of Surgeons in Edinburgh and the Royal College of Surgeons and Physicians in Glasgow. In London, there was the College of Surgeons of London. Later it got a Royal Charter. It had broken away from the Barber Surgeons from which it had been attached since 1540, and in 1745 it became the College of Surgeons in London, and in 1800 the Royal College of Surgeons in London. These colleges were there to train, teach, examine, and also to audit results of Royal Naval and Army results on campaign. Having passed the examination, which was just oral, so we have little written evidence of questions apart from the odd crib book written, the young surgeon would then venture out into one of the Royal Navy ships or to a regiment as an assistant surgeon or into a military type hospital as an assistant surgeon to the forces. We now have to consider what abilities, surgical knowledge and techniques were available around the time of the Battle of Waterloo, or let's say the Napoleonic Wars in general. It's fair to say great leads should have been taken from the French, who started off as a new republic with great verve and enthusiasm, and it demanded much of its medical service, the service de santé. And it was here that Larrey and Percy, which we have previously mentioned, evolved a system of close surgical support in the front line, using sprung vehicles and having dedicated stretcher bearers so that surgery sometimes could be taken literally at the front and patients could be moved out quickly. Because heretofore, before these wars, you just lay on the battlefield wounded until somebody came and picked you up after the action. And this is clearly unacceptable, particularly to the Republicans in France. The French were particularly in the ascendancy with their surgery and military surgery in the earlier part of the war. But it has to be said, as the Napoleonic Empire was formed and expanded, the French lost many of its doctors, it ran out of money, it was overburdened by bureaucracy. So what about the British naval and military practice? Well, they again, at the beginning of the war, like the French, needed a lot of experience and were inexperienced, both in organisation and due to the inability to treat overwhelming swathes of disease, such as were seen in the Low Countries in the late part of the 18th century and also in the West Indies, where yellow fever was a particular challenge. Most people still are dying of dysentery, febrile problems such as typhoid, malaria, and viral infections. And of course, there was very little that could be done about that. Surgeons had to be involved in treating medical diseases because there simply weren't enough physicians. And on the whole, physicians were not terribly experienced on campaign and in warfare. So generally for febrile episodes and various diseases of then unknown etiology, there was a practice called the antiphlogistic regimen, which means the anti-inflammatory regimen. This was a regimen of treatment meant to prevent disease. It amounted to bleeding the patient, venesection, taking blood off, perhaps about a pint at a time, either with a lancet, a thumb lancet, leeches, or wet cupping and scarification. Apart from bleeding, it also the treatment consisted of making the patient vomit, emesis, or having a very vigorous bowel action, a catharsis. And there were various drugs to promote these treatments. Of course, the last thing most victims of disease or wounding needed was to be bled or made sick or have diarrhea. So the treatment, the antiphlogistic regimen, was particularly useless and in fact dangerous. As far as general surgical knowledge at the time of Waterloo and the Napoleonic Wars, there's no doubt that the study of anatomy, later in universities, but often in extramural schools, particularly of anatomy, particularly north of the border, was an important subject. And there was rudimentary pathology, materia medica, and midwifery, which wasn't perhaps so much pertaining to the military surgeon, although they did have to look after families and women on campaign. As far as techniques of surgery were concerned, the assistant surgeon going into the front line would be expected to tell and prognosticate if a patient was going to die or whether he could be saved. There is some mention occasionally of triage, or the separation of injuries according to severity, but really not during this war particularly. These are often triages ascribed to Baron Larrey, but it wasn't practiced widely. The assistant surgeon in the front line would bind wounds, control bleeding, perhaps administer a painkiller, but that's unusual. It would maybe suture up a wound and get the patient back to more safe surroundings where more senior surgeons, namely the main regimental surgeon or staff surgeons, hospital surgeons, could treat the patient. The common techniques were bandaging wounds with linen bandages, searching for foreign bodies, opening or dilating the wound and putting bullet forceps in, removing bits of clothing or indriven secondary missiles, amputation, trepanation of the skull, splinting fractures, sometimes catheterizing the bladder or the stomach for perineal or neck wounds, respectively. So it was a fairly limited repertoire. But when you look at the number of procedures that could be done by a surgeon as compared to the type of drugs and diagnostic ability in a physician, one could see during this 23-year-long war an ascendancy of surgery and the beginning of militarization of surgery. Surgeons had to learn to be soldiers as well as doctors, and they had particular types of injuries to look after. There's very little knowledge about mental disease. There was a lot of support between soldiers when they were injured, and of course casualty numbers from disease, and sometimes perhaps 1 in 5 deaths were caused to battle injury, and 4 out of 5 were caused by disease, climate, or accident.